It is 1 o'clock. This is the meeting of the House Judiciary today. Let the record reflect that Representative Leonard is present, Representative Lynn is present, Representative Grunberg is present, Vice Chair Keller is present, and I'm the Chair, Representative Ledoux, I'm present. Also, I'd like the record to reflect that Representative Kurt Olson is now an alternative for the House Judiciary Committee, but he is not present today. To begin with, please silence your electronic devices or you'll end up giving us donuts. Thank you. We only have one item before us today, and that is a hearing for Governor Walker's appointee to be Attorney General, Craig Richards. I'd like to remind you that our job here is only to review the history and qualifications of Mr. Richards. There will be no vote for or against his confirmation. Committee members should feel free to ask questions as they arise, but bear in mind that we are not voting on his qualifications, only reviewing them. Now, Mr. Richards, could you please put your name on the record and give us a brief history of your professional qualifications?
Thank you, Chairwoman. My name is Craig Richards, personal residence of 1435 N Street, Anchorage, Alaska. I did prepare a brief five-minute background, if with your chair's pleasure.
Absolutely. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Chairwoman. So I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. My family moved there when I was 2 years old from Georgia. I had had an aunt in the mid-50s, a woman by the name of Mary Shakora, who had moved up and met my great-uncle Fred in the 1950s, and since that time, a lot of my mother's family from the Georgia side ended up moving up to Alaska, so we actually ended up with a pretty big contingent of Georgians up here over the years. My father had the opportunity to move up with federal probation in 1977, right at the end of the pipeline construction era, so my family jumped on it. He worked in federal probation and as a state trooper, a brown shirt, through his entire professional career, where he ultimately did retire in federal probation a few years ago. My mother also lived in Fairbanks until just the last couple of months. She worked at Consolidated Freightways, was the office manager at Spinard Builder Supply for a number of years, and for the last 20 years, until November, operated All Seasons Inn Bed and Breakfast, which is in downtown Fairbanks, catty corner to the old courthouse. I went to Wood River Elementary, and then when Pearl Creek opened in Fairbanks in about 1982 or 1983, I transferred over there. I attended Ryan and ultimately graduated from West Valley High School in 1993. From there, I attended the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I studied finance. That's the area I concentrated in their business school. I knew as a young man, even as the rest of my cohorts went off to Wall Street to do banking, that I was going to come back to Alaska. So went immediately from the undergraduate program there at Virginia to Washington and Lee Law School, also in Virginia, where I studied law for the pretty much express purpose of coming back to Alaska. I did that in 2000. My first job was to clerk for Ralph Beislein. Ralph Beislein, of course, is now on the U.S. District Court, but at the time he was on the Superior Court in Fairbanks, and I actually had the neat experience of being his law clerk when he was going through the federal confirmation process. So that was a pretty cool civics exercise. First job I had after clerking for Ralph Beislein was at Wolforth, Vassar, Johnson & Breck in Anchorage. That law firm was founded by Eric Wolforth back in the 60s. He was brought up to do some municipal bonding after the earthquake and decided to settle and create a law firm. I did that work with well-known public finance attorneys in the state, Eric Wolforth, Ken Vassar, Cheryl Brookings, Cindy Cartledge, and a few others. And I did public finance for about 2 years and was really where I learned how to be a finance and a transactional attorney. In 2003, I had the opportunity to go work for a gentleman by the name of Bill Walker, who was doing some financings on the Valdez Marine Terminal for the oil companies, and I had been working the deal from another side as well. So I took that three-month job to work with Mr. Walker in 2003, and 12 years later I was still working for him. So during the course of that time, I did have the opportunity to go back to Durham, North Carolina at Duke University, where I got my MBA. I had been a practicing attorney for a number of years at that point and had spent a good deal of time doing finance and oil and gas, so that's where I really focused my MBA studies, particularly quantitative modeling on the oil and gas side. So I think it's fair to say that I'm not just an attorney, but I'm a fairly competent quant on the oil and gas side as well. During the course of my practice, I focused primarily on four areas: municipal law, public finance, oil and gas taxation in the state of Alaska, and gas pipeline development. And I would say that those four areas probably occupied 80 or 90% of my practice over the last decade. In terms of my personal family, I'm married to Allison Richards. She's a teacher at West High School in Anchorage. She teaches English at the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade levels. I have one son, a boy by the name of Cameron. He'll be 2 in May. And the final thoughts I thought I'd share with you before we go into the open questions was just my thought on why I want to be Attorney General. I think that might be a nice way to open up. And I have to say that it's not really where I expected my life to take me. I certainly have witnessed and enjoyed Governor Walker's run for the governorship, both in 2010 and 2014. And I suspected that if he won in office, that he would go into office and I would have taken over the law firm. That was certainly my expectation. Just as if he lost, I figured he was going to retire and I was going to take over the law firm. So I pretty much thought that my life was on a pretty set course. But about a week before the election, he asked me if he won, if I would consider this job. And I had to take some time to think about it. But ultimately, even though it wasn't without sacrifices in the terms of giving up what was an established law practice and obviously agreeing to spend a lot of time away from my family, I just decided the opportunity to serve the people of Alaska was once in a lifetime, and I'd be crazy not to take it.
Thank you. Please note for the record that Representative Foster has joined us. So do we thank you very much, Mr. Richards. Thank you for your willingness to serve. So do we have any questions for Mr. Richards? Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Good morning. Good to see you. So I have a question on your oil and gas policy. One thing that you did comment on in 2012 in the ADN, you describe it, ways the North Slope leases are obligated to market. And would you, under what circumstances, do you think that the state should compel lessees to produce their gas resources? And would you sue the producers to compel them to sell their product?
Representative Millett, through the chair, if I can take a minute, it's a little more sophisticated than that, so maybe I'll share my thoughts in terms of how the oil and gas leases work, and this is sort of oil and gas 101. About 100 years ago in America, there was an open question about whether an oil company that had an oil and gas lease from a landowner could act self-interestedly or whether they owe a duty of care to the landowner. And by about the 1920s, 1930s, it was pretty well established that, in fact, oil companies do owe the landowner a duty of care. And in particular, that's to fully develop the leasehold and to market a leasehold, oil and gas off the leasehold, if there's a reasonable expectation of profit. And the primary reason that that duty exists is to ensure that the landowner has the ability to fully utilize and take advantage of royalty income. So when you talk about the duty to develop or the duty to market, slightly different obligations, what you're really talking about is the right of the landowner to have an expectation to receive his royalty income. So typically, in a duty to develop suit, the ultimate remedy is it's secondarily the forcing of production. It is primarily the right to payment on lost royalty. So if the state was in a position where it was not receiving royalty because of the refusal to develop, it would be DNR's prerogative, if it chose, to seek lost royalty. But I don't have any expectation or intent right now that I'm aware of from DNR to file such a suit.
Follow up?
Yes.
So you believe there's intent in the lessee to, there's a duty to produce, and you believe that when they lease, there's a compelling, if profitable, that they should produce their gas at whatever cost?
Yeah, I do. The implied covenant is not only implied in the law in every state, but I think it's also in the case of the DL-1 lease form expressly stated.
Hello. So in Governor Walker's remarks the other day, when he was upset about House Bill 132, he made an implication at the end of his press conference that he would sue the owners, the lessees of the land and the North Slope for duty to produce if they did not produce gas for the gas pipeline. Is that my understanding of what he said?
Well, I actually didn't hear his comments, so I don't know what he said. But again, it's DNR's choice about whether or not they feel that the lessees are not living up to their expectations, and a remedy that they would have available through DNR would be to file a suit for lost royalty.
Follow up? So would that be a decision for DNR, or would you take an active role in that decision?
So it would be a decision for DNR. It would be a decision that directly came through the standard plan of development process. And I would take a role to the extent DNR sought legal advice from the Attorney General's office on how that process should occur,
and
if it should occur.
And follow up? And so if the DNR came to you and said that they believed that there was a duty, implied duty to produce off the leases, and they weren't producing because the profit margins weren't something that they could agree with, or the pipeline ownership wasn't agree with, you would be compelled to give the advice to, that they should sue the leasees?
I wouldn't be compelled to give them advice they should sue the leasees. I'd be compelled to give them the advice as to what their legal options are.
Okay. When does the duty to, under this analysis, when does the duty to produce come into play? I assume that it wouldn't come into play unless the producers were able to show that you could profitably produce. Am I correct with that?
So there are two parts to that, if I might, through the chair. The first is, it's not just a duty to produce. There's actually four implied covenants that people typically talk about. There's a duty to explore, a duty to develop, a duty to produce, and a duty to market. And each of these have their own unique circumstances under the body of common law. So each of those arises at a slightly different time. But at least with a duty to market and a duty to produce, the rule is that the landowner would only have a remedy against the oil and gas lessee if they could demonstrate that their failure to develop was despite a reasonable expectation of profit. So it's my understanding of the law that the burden would shift on to the landowner to actually demonstrate that there was a failure to develop when there was an expectation of profit. So that's a way of me saying it wouldn't be up to the oil company to show there was an expectation of profit. It would be up to the landowner to show that there was a failure to develop when there was a reasonable expectation of profit.
What sort of a profit? I mean, profit can be that you could make a penny. A profit can be that you can make $1 billion. I mean, does the case law describe what it means by profit?
It does. I think it's pretty well settled if you look at lower 48 jurisdictions. And there's never been an Alaska case, so that's why I reference, for instance, Texas as a very well-defined body of law in this. And the standard is, would you meet the internal cost of capital of a reasonably prudent operator, is a summation of how I interpret the standard. And there's two parts of that. One is, there is a recognition that it's not you make a penny. It's that there would be a return on a positive net present value basis where you meet your internal hurdle rates. The second part is that you never measure it from the basis of the individual lessee, the individual oil company. You always make the measurement based upon a reasonably prudent operator. That's the theoretical third-party reasonable operator that does an oil and gas lease, because the idea of this body of law is that you don't look to the individual circumstances of the oil company. You don't look to their individual capitalization. You don't look to projects they have around the world. You don't look to how they want to act. Rather, the way the law has been interpreted is to create this third-party standard, sort of like the reasonable person standard in torts and negligence, that says, how would a reasonably prudent operator act in that circumstance? So that's the hypothetical duty of care owed to the landowner that you measure against.
And these duties to produce, they're totally common law? They're not written into the leases at all?
They are totally common law. You're testing my knowledge of the DL-1 lease form, I have to admit. It's been a number of years. My recollection is that the DL-1 lease form in the remedy section does reference the implied covenants. But I don't, it's been probably 4 or 5 years since I've looked at that.
Thank you. Representative Miller.
Thank you. Just to follow up, so I understand, what my understanding is that your administration would like to build 100% and own a gas pipeline. In that situation, if the transportation costs were such that producers chose not to ship in they didn't own a portion of the pipe, the transportation costs were out of their control, but you still compelled them to produce, to put into that pipe. Is that a situation you see getting into where the tariff could be so expensive that the profits would be marginal for a producer, let's say?
So I guess, Representative Millett, through the chair, a couple thoughts here. The first is just to say, my personal view is you're never going to sue a pipeline into existence. So I don't personally ever think that the duty to develop can be used to force a $60 billion development project to occur. That being said, I do think that the oil and gas lessors on the North Slope are sophisticated. They know their leases, they know their obligations and their rights, and certainly if AKLNG didn't go forward and an independent pipeline became credible, I think that they would understand that they would have a duty to sell product into that project if there was a reasonable expectation of profit. And if they didn't have a reasonable expectation of profit, they wouldn't have the duty to market.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you would look at the first page of your resume.
I don't have a copy, but I...
Well, I'll quote you.
Sounds great.
But the first is, would you please recite this from memory?
I think I did at the beginning, basically.
Thanks, Tom. At the first paragraph, second to last line, regularly built sophisticated valuation, Monte Carlo, and other decision models, etc. What's Monte Carlo besides a casino?
Monte Carlo is a statistical means to measure outcomes. It's a probabilistic modeling is what it's called. In decision modeling, you can have deterministic or probabilistic analysis. And what probabilistic does, what Monte Carlo and Monte Carlo software does, is it says we recognize there's a range of possible outcomes, so we'll build the chance of all of these outcomes occurring based upon distributions, and then it runs 25,000 different, basically flips of the coin on each of these chances to see what the most likely outcome is given a bunch of different variables and possible outcomes. So I'm not sure that that was very clear.
That was more than clear for me as a political science major. May I continue, please?
Go ahead.
Then I would like to ask you, looking at this, it looks to me like you, and probably your firm too, but particularly you, mainly had a transactional or office practice rather than a courtroom or litigation practice. Is that right?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I would say that was right the first 5 years, or probably until about 2009. And then all of the transactional work I did in tax cases became litigation, and my what was state oil and gas tax practice took on a different character, particularly in the tax evaluation dispute cases, where I represented the city of Valdez in a number of trials and very complex litigation cases. So yes, until it wasn't, and then I found myself litigating quite heavily, quite extensively, and for probably more than half of my time the last 5 years.
May I continue, please?
Go ahead.
What I was getting at is you're going to be, I doubt you're going to be litigating many cases yourself as the Attorney General. You're going to be the senior partner in the biggest law firm in the state, but you're going to be administering both people who do transactional work and counsel various agencies and people who do a lot of litigating. And I'm trying to get at your experience as a nuts and bolt litigator. Whether you know what it's like to go in front of a jury, whether you know what it's like to go in front of an administrative agency, whether you know what it's like with the rules of evidence and how to strategize a case to either prevent an appeal or build in an appeal. Tell me what you know. Chair.
I believe, and I hope it doesn't sound egotistical, but I believe I have an incredibly strong background in complex litigation. I've done probably some of the most complex litigation that's been handled in the state of Alaska the last 5 or 6 years. I've done it full time, and I've done it at extremely high risks with a whole lot of people with me and against me. So I feel very confident in my ability to manage sophisticated large cases.
Thank you. Obviously, the governor does too. No further questions.
Representative Mellott.
Thank you. Since Representative Grunberg brought up the TAPS case, the state has asserted the North Slope Borough and the city of Valdez exceeded the amount they were allowed to collect for the tax cap on TAPS. So there was a letter from the division to the state assessor on August 24, 2012. The North Slope Borough may owe about $49.7 million, and the city of Valdez may owe about $56.7 million for a total of about $106 million. It might be that it's due to the state. So is your administration started proceedings to collect the money from the local governments, and Are you committed to collecting the government, and what is the status of the disagreement?
So the couple parts of that, let's start with the status. Representative Lethbridge,
Chair. Before you answer that question, I need to announce that Representative Klayman has joined us. Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you. So I did represent the city of Valdez in private practice in that case, as did the governor. I have delegated my authority to that case to Martin Schultz, who's the section head of oil, gas, and mining. It was one of a number of cases that I delegated before I took office after consulting both with an outside legal attorney and also with the ethics attorney within the Department of Law, and was advised to delegate until a number of things happened, just as other attorney generals have delegated their prior cases involving litigation with the state from their private practice. So the answer is that I frankly am not particularly up to date with where the current status is because I'm not involved in the cases. But I know enough about the case that I can surmise, and I surmise that they're still before the Superior Court with the municipalities arguing that they don't owe the money and the state arguing that they do.
What kind of Chinese wall have you built around Mr. Schultz?
I think that the Department of Law is very used to having these kinds of Chinese walls in terms of different matters. So I don't know that anything special had to be done other than the fact that he knows that the decision is delegated to him and that not to me. So I essentially am out of the loop. He's making the decisions.
Is he going through a confirmation process?
He's not.
How many cases have been delegated to Mr. Schultz? And
so there, Representative Ledoux, to my knowledge, there were four, one of which was Mr. Walker's Point Thompson litigation, which is now dismissed, so that leaves three cases. And I say three. Many of these cases have multiple facets to them, so three would be the subject matter. 10 or 12 might be the number of cases, maybe even more. So there is one property tax case for the city of Valdez. There's the tax value litigation, and then there is the tax cap case, which is really a derivative of the tax value litigation. It's a secondary level of cases associated with those outcomes.
So you say that nothing special has been done because this has been these wrongs have been done with other attorney generals. So what is done? I mean, what's the process of building some sort of I guess they call it a Chinese wall. That's the term that I've heard to make sure that there is absolutely nothing going from Mr. Schultz to you and from you to Mr. Schultz with respect to these cases.
Well, I'm not sure that there's any more of a process than to put the formal delegations in place. And delegations in this area of law or any kind of formal delegation at the state level, there's a process they use that makes the delegation public. I'm not even really familiar with what it is. I just know that it goes up on a website and it's publicly available. And once that occurs, then the attorney that handles the matter that has the delegation is then the one responsible for building the wall and deciding, you know, what communication flows outside of his group. And because the Department of Law often has different attorneys working on matters for different sides, like you have two state agencies and the Department of Law represents both state agencies, and they might have slightly different interests, it's pretty common for the Department of Law to do that.
Generally speaking, you don't have two state agencies suing each other in court, though, do you?
It does happen. And in that situation, you do build a Chinese wall within the Department of Law.
Representative Millett and then Representative Klayman.
Thank you. How involved are you in the AKLNG negotiations project, and have you signed a confidentiality agreement?
I have been moderately involved in the sense of I attended one meeting. I was supposed to go in person in Houston last week. I had a personal emergency in my family, so ended up attending by telephone, and I have not signed a confidentiality agreement, so my attendance was totally based on publicly available information.
Follow up? So in January, you told the Journal of Commerce you plan to institute a state policy potentially in conflict with the legislative direction that we gave already given in law to the state entities related to confidentiality. So what makes you think a policy handed down by the AG is good public business, open and transparent? Isn't this, in a sense, by bypassing the public process, a part of a legislator's work in crafting a policy that will help statute?
Representative Millett, through the chair, I'm not sure exactly. I certainly wouldn't do anything that's contrary to state law as enacted. I will say that at the request of the governor, I have had probably four or five conversations with folks at AKLNG and with folks at AGDC to try to create processes whereby information that is public can flow up to the public, and so that the people of the state of Alaska can get a better sense of what's going on within the project. But I certainly don't believe that I've done anything that is contrary to law enacted by this body.
Will you be signing a confidentiality agreement for the AKLNG project?
It is not my current intention to do so.
Okay. Representative Klayman.
Following up on questions from the chair, you identified four cases on which you had essentially removed yourself from for consideration of those cases as Attorney General. That was those that were given to Mr. Schultz, I think, to monitor. Are there any other? Oh, sorry. Are there any other cases on which you've declared a conflict other than those four that Schultz is supervising? Because I recognize there may be other cases that you might have a conflict, and I'm just trying to get the full arena of cases in which you may have a conflict that you've declared already.
Representative Clayton, through the chair, those are the only ones.
Thank you.
Follow up on that one.
Yes, go ahead, Representative
Keller. Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you tell me again the four cases? You got the Valdez case, you've got the one that Governor Walker stepped back from. What are the two cases, are there?
So the four cases are the Representative Keller through the chair. The four cases are the TAPS valuation cases. That's the ongoing dispute as to the ad valorem taxable value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System. The second one is a series of cases that have been going on for about 15 years or longer between the City of Valdez and the Department of Revenue about whether or not some of the marine property servicing the Valdez Marine Terminal should be subject to an ad valorem tax. To say it's arcane would be an understatement. There's probably five lawyers that even know the cases exist, but nonetheless, I was involved, so those were delegations. And then there was Point Thompson. And then the fourth case was the tax cap case, which, again, was really derivative of the TAPS value litigation, but it is a separate case and a separate docket, so it's fair to list it by itself.
So do you view the role of Attorney General as working for the people of the state of Alaska, or for the governor, or for both? And we got into this in judiciary. I'm kind of an advocate of an elected attorney general, and then the governor would have his counsel. How do you view the role of attorney general?
Well, I think that as the attorney general, you do represent the governor's office, and you do represent the various state agencies, but your primary obligation is clearly to be the people's attorney. That's your primary obligation. So you manage all of those things by providing as good a legal counsel as you can to all the various state agencies, including the governor's office. But ultimately, it is an independent office, and your primary obligation is to the people. So to the extent that you would have a conflict, it is always the duty of the Attorney General in the state of Alaska to act on behalf of the people before the governor or before any state agency.
How does that work with not only the governor's office, but with the state agencies as far as confidentiality of the attorney-client relationship? I mean, you're working for the agency, but you're working for the people, or you're working for the governor and you're working for the people. How does that work?
Well, it does work, and Alaska isn't unique. Every attorney general most, if not all, of attorney generals throughout the country operate under the exact same framework. Some don't actually represent the governor's office. There's independent counsel, but many do. And ultimately, I don't see any issue with the confidentiality, because even at the end of the day, for instance, you disagreed with a commissioner on some issue, and you felt that the people's interest required the Department of Law to take another approach other than what a commissioner wanted, you wouldn't necessarily lose the confidences or need to disclose them. You just do as Attorney General what you think the public interest requires.
Representative Klayman, and then Representative Millett.
follow up on that, your last response to the chair's question, would it be part of your obligation, let's say that Department of Transportation had one view and then you were asked to review that and you concluded that Department of Transportation was wrong and you were officially taking a position, would part of your obligation not only to take the official position of the state as their attorney in court, but also to properly educate Department of Transportation about what is the law that should be applied to their to their agency, or not their agency, but to their department?
Representative Klayman, through the chair, that's correct. And there have been more than one fairly public disputes in the history of the state of Alaska where a commissioner has disagreed with an attorney general, and the attorney general has had to make it clear that it is ultimately the attorney general's office, in certain circumstances, that makes determinations as to Alaska law and the public's interest.
And follow up, not related to that, but separately, you just described kind of conflicts. You practiced law with the governor for a number of years. Were there occasions, without disclosing the client or the context, in which you and the governor didn't see eye to eye, but you were comfortable advocating for your perspective on things and convincing the then practicing attorney Bill Walker of the correctness of your perspective?
Representative Klayman, I think it's fair to say that that happened a number of times.
Representative Mellon.
Thank you. Two lawsuits I wanted to talk to you about. One is the Ketchikan school funding case. During the campaign, the governor supported the Ketchikan lawsuit. The second is the land, tribal land lawsuit that's been, I think it received a stay. What are your positions on both those lawsuits?
So, Representative Millett, through the chair, obviously with ongoing litigation, you know, I can tell you about where we are in the procedure, but I can't discuss in open forum the strategy of litigation. But I'm happy to address both cases to the extent I can. On the Ketchikan case, the state, the Superior Court judge ruled in part for Ketchikan, ruling that the local required contribution did violate the dedicated funds clause, but ultimately also ruling that the state did not have the obligation to make up the local required contribution for the local communities. That issue, the judge originally held that that was the law and would not grant a stay. We went up to the Supreme Court, where ultimately the state did get a stay. So now basically things are on hold, at least from an enforcement perspective, until the Supreme Court has the opportunity to address the state's position. We are moving forward with the same position that the state had in prior litigation, although obviously the state could always change its position, but certainly we're appealing with the same appeal points that were consistent with the last administration. The other case you asked about, I'm sorry, please remind me.
The tribal lands.
Tribal lands case. So the tribal lands case is, we did ask for a stay of 6 months, and by we, I mean I asked for a stay of 6 months to have the opportunity to study the issue and learn it. There is no change in position one way or the other than I asked the court for a six-month breather to have the opportunity to learn the body law.
On the same topic, you know, in general, we have, you know, obviously challenges from the feds, it seems like, and where jumps to mind. Just talk to us a little bit about that whole thing, about, you know, the people's attorney standing up for our right to, for lands and access under an ILCA, et cetera, if you just give me
Representative Keller through the chair. I certainly view the particular circumstances of the Attorney General in Alaska, that a very important role that they play as the people's attorney is to standing up for state sovereignty and to standing up for the state's rights under a number of different packages, the Statehood Compact and ILCA, ANCSCA, to ensure that our rights are respected by the federal government. So I'm certainly consistent with that. As to ANWR, of course, my office has continued a number of cases from the prior attorney general, and some of which that run back several attorney generals, that do that in certain circumstances, and we're moving forward with ANWR, for instance, on the challenge that the state has the right to file a non-drilling exploration plan in ANWR, as well as a challenge to some of the borders of where ANWR actually lies. The current issue that's most timely and the one that's coming up is a little bit less a litigation issue than it is a policy issue, and that, of course, is President Obama's new position through Secretary Jewell that ANWR should be treated as wilderness notwithstanding an extra act of Congress. So are we looking at ways to support the administration in that pushback? We are, but there has not yet been consideration about litigation.
Did Ketchikan cross the plan?
They did.
So what will be the state's position on the cross appeal?
It will be opposing the cross appeal. I'm trying to think if there's any nuances where it's not, but I'm not aware of any. So the main area where they're cross appealing is they had two claims that they lost on, which was that the local required contribution violates the veto clause and the appropriation clause, as well as, I think, if I'm correct, they believe that the state should actually be required to make up the funds if the local contribution is struck down. So in those circumstances, the appeal points we're drafting are consistent with defending the state's position in the spirit before the Superior Court.
So they're consistent with defending the state's position in the Superior Court litigation, but not necessarily consistent with the governor's position during his campaign, because it sounds a little bit inconsistent from, I guess, what I remember during the campaign.
So I recall reading an article once where Governor Walker said that he was sympathetic to Ketchikan's lawsuit, but that's the sum total of the knowledge I have about the governor's position, and frankly, I haven't discussed it with him.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up on that same...
Representative Kamen through the chair.
Thank you. Follow-up on the same question, because Representative Millett asked a very, I think, useful question about what the governor may or may not have said during his campaign and the Ketchikan lawsuit and whether... So I'm, now that I'm... And I'm not one who has studied the Ketchikan lawsuit at this point, but... Where, if anywhere, was the governor sympathetic with the position of the plaintiffs in the Ketchikan lawsuit, and where does that, how does that differ from the state's position in any of the three areas that are at issue in the Ketchikan litigation? And I guess the third part is there potential that the state may be changing its position as to one or more of the appeal points as we move forward, because it sounds like the briefing is nowhere near complete?
Representative Klayman, as I said, I genuinely don't know what the governor's personal position is, other than, as I said, I think in one of the debates he said he was sympathetic. That's really the only time I've talked to him. As to whether or not the state could change its positions, I mean, I guess it always could, but there's no present intent to, and ultimately, of course, how to proceed in litigation is my decision. So,
well, the strategy for how to proceed in litigation might be your decision, but the policy matter would be the administration's decision, wouldn't it?
Representative Ledoux, I would...
Governor's decision.
Representative Ledoux, I respectively would disagree. It is the Attorney General's position on how to proceed in any litigation, both in terms of filing, disposition, and strategy.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, Klinkenheide, decision, federally recognized tribe, and obviously not consistent with at least our Constitution. How would you proceed on that? What is there, how do you view it?
Representative Kelly, through the chair, you're going to actually have to give me a little more clarity on what the decision was about.
I'm sorry. They authorized tribal marriage of same-sex couples, and So is it the role of the AG to challenge that?
So, Representative Kelly, through the chair, if I thought that their position was inconsistent with the laws of the state of Alaska in a way that violates our laws, I'm trying to think how to say this. They're a separate sovereign. I believe they have the power under the recognized case law to adopt, as between their own members, their own body of law. The question is whether or not the state would recognize that is the question. And frankly, the issue is going to be decided pretty dispositively in the litigation associated with Hamby, which is going to be decided pretty dispositively by the Supreme Court this term in terms about whether or not there's a constitutional right to gay marriage or not at the federal level.
Representative Millett and then Representative Kleiner.
Can you tell me what you think your role in the National Guard will be in changing laws specific to the National Guard?
Representative Millett, through the chair. So my role as Attorney General will not be to take the lead on reforming the National Guard. That, of course, is a National Guard function and an executive function. So my role, I would say, would really be twofold. First would be to the extent the National Guard seeks legal advice to help them, you know, either enact the Military Justice Code or to have any other legal changes where they need legal advice. Clearly, the Department of Law would provide them that legal advice. Second is we're going to have a report out from Patricia Collins, who's the special investigator. Patricia Collins will make recommendations, if any, as to, at least in her view, prosecutions that should occur. So the primary role of our office will be to review her recommendations and make a decision as to how to move forward.
Representative Klayman, and then I've got a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is actually a follow-up to your discussions with the Chair about this distinction between position and policy, because I'm sure you're familiar with that there are a number of areas in which the attorney gets to make the strategy call in court, a perfect example being, although there's a right to a jury trial in a civil matter, the lawyer can choose to disagree with his or her client and say, well, I understand your view is different, but I'm, as your lawyer, I'm choosing a non-jury trial, for example, even though you have a right to a jury trial. And that's not something the client gets to express their preference, but in the specific example of school funding, as is raised by the Ketchikan suit, at some level, that could be not just a question of statutory interpretation, but that could come to a policy question that's uniquely a question for the governor's office or for the executive branch generally to take a position. And I'm explaining that a little bit more because it certainly seems to me that when we look into the details of those relationships, there are circumstances under which the executive branch says to its attorney, Mr. Richards, that this is the position we want you to take on our behalf, and your advice to them may well be position A or position B or both positions that there is a legal basis to take either position, and you might, were you the executive, you might choose position B, but if the governor chooses position A, you're, at least as I read that typical analysis, you would be expected to support position A and the official position of the state. Can you, in light of your earlier discussions with Representative Ledoux, can you talk a little more about that when we're really talking about an area in which the client gets to make a choice?
Representative Klayman, through the chair. So I agree with that a little bit, and I don't agree with it a little bit. So let me explain my understanding. So as the Attorney General, as an attorney within the Department of Law, you certainly have clients, and that can be an agency client or it can be the governor's office. And as an attorney for that client, you certainly take direction and you enable their decision-making and provide them legal advice, just like a private attorney does and attorneys do every day. But there is a slight distinction in that your primary representation is to the public interest. It's not to any one individual governmental client. So you always follow direction from your client until you have a theoretical situation where you think that your client is taking a position that is not consistent with the public interest, in which case the duty shifts to the Attorney General's office being obligated to, in fact, take positions that are in the public interest. And I know this is a little counterintuitive. I'd be happy to send over a 1995 Attorney General's opinion that Bruce Botello did that lays out the historical artifice of the office and the laws in the state of Alaska and sort of why there is this nuanced difference, which is a little different than what you have in private practice.
But
I have a follow-up.
All right, I'll let you up. You're following up in kind of the area that I was going to follow, so go ahead.
This is
Competitive follow-up. All right, and so it's easy to kind of say, okay, well, I've got to follow the public interest, but I'm actually not necessarily artfully trying to draw a situation in which you as the Attorney General really can say to the governor, and we won't worry about a separate department, you can say to the governor, there is a sound basis to support both arguments, and there is a sound basis to support both arguments in the public interest, and that there's public interest support for either one. How is there a point in there in which you're going to say, I need to follow the governor's direction?
The only reason that you wouldn't follow the governor's direction or any other agency client is if you think a position they wanted you to take was not in the public interest. So in that circumstance, I mean, this is hypothetical because we're drawing hypotheticals. I mean, you're always going to follow the direction of your client as the Attorney General unless you think the direction of your client is not in the public interest.
Well, I find this extremely confusing, and I'd really like to see that memorandum that you talk about, because what I think I'm hearing you say is that you, as an appointed official, you get to decide, or you, meaning the Attorney General, gets to decide what's best for the public, even though there could be two reasonable people could come to the conclusion. I mean, you know, in this body, all over, there are people that I agree with and people that I disagree with. But I kind of believe that most of us are trying to follow the public interest. So it's really confusing to me when I'm hearing you say that you get to decide what the public interest is when, in most cases, you'll come to your attorney and you'll say, I want to do A. And your attorney will say either, okay, you got a 30%, 40%, 50% chance of prevailing on A. And the client will say, well, I really want to do A, and I'll take my chances that even if it's only 30%. And as long as it's not down to the, you know, you got a 0% chance of winning, as an attorney, you can do that work without it being frivolous litigation. So, I mean, many people looked at the Ketchikan case, for example, and didn't think that there was very much chance that that case was going to prevail in the first place. And it did prevail, at least on the Superior Court level. So it's just very confusing to me when you say that you get to be the final arbiter of the public interest.
Madam Chairman, thank you. It's the nature of the Attorney General office in the state of Alaska and throughout the country. It's an independent office, and that's just how the Attorneys Generals operate throughout the country, is that ultimately, as an independent office holder, you do make those final decisions in certain specific areas, primarily in the terms of the bringing, the disposition, and the handling of litigation.
But the handling of litigation is a strategic call. It's not necessarily a policy call as to whether you do the litigation in the first place. I mean, whether you do the litigation in the first place, that's the policy call. And then once you've decided to do the litigation, then it's up to the Attorney General to figure out how you can win the litigation. Is that incorrect?
I would respectfully characterize it as a little different. I believe it's pretty clear and express under Alaska law that the filing, the disposition, and the handling of all litigation is an independent matter for the Attorney General.
Okay. Well, if you can get that memo to us, I think a number of us would actually like to see that. Representative Klayman, it looks like you would like to follow up too.
I have a follow-up on it. You made reference to that. Is it the Hamby case that's before the U.S. Supreme Court now on same-sex marriage, or am I getting the case name wrong?
Well, the Hamby case is Alaska's, Representative Klayman through the chair, is Alaska's case that's before the Ninth Circuit that is on stay.
Okay.
The U.S. Supreme Court has taken cert in another case, several cases, with very virtually identical constitutional provisions from other states.
Okay, so further follow-up through the chair.
Go ahead.
So the prior administration in the Hanby case took the position before the federal district court and I believe before the Ninth Circuit, and I'm not saying where it is in the briefing, but the prior administration took the position that it was advocating that the Alaska constitutional provision approved by the voters was constitutional and should be enforced, and arguing against the plaintiffs in that particular case. That case is now on hold, but has this administration, will this administration making any submission to the U.S. Supreme Court on whatever the case is before the U.S. Supreme Court on same-sex marriage, and has this administration made any decision about what its position is in the Hanby case, which is the case coming out of Alaska in which it has been involved?
No decisions have been made yet other than to seek a stay, but I can tell you that my duty as Attorney General is to defend the state constitution, and the state constitution is clear. So barring a federal decision by the United States Supreme Court that makes clear that the federal constitution trumps the state constitution, it's my duty to defend the state constitution. And we'll have that answer in June. Probably, I suppose. I guess I shouldn't speak for what the Supreme Court is going to do, but it would be my expectation that the Supreme Court will rule in June and it will provide clear guidance as to whether or not the federal constitution trumps the state constitution in this instance.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. So during the past, you've been pretty critical of some of the legislation that we've passed in the legislature, House Bill 4 and SB 21, even after the referendum on SB 21. Do you think that that will influence the way you you handle the Department of Law? Is there any forthcoming legislation that will change any of those two bills that you see putting forward?
Representative Millett, through the chair, I mean, my duty as the Attorney General is to fully and faithfully execute the laws of the state of Alaska as passed by this body or by voter initiative. So whether or not I disagreed with some policy matters associated with bills in the past isn't going to change my obligation, which is to enforce state law. In terms of whether I'm working on, I wouldn't be sponsoring litigation. It would be an administrative agency that was sponsoring legislation. And I'm not working on anything to affect either SB 21 or HB 4, and no one has come to the Attorney General's office, to my knowledge, and asked us to.
So, so your opinions on those won't influence you in any way? Your personal opinions about SB 21 and HB 4?
I don't believe so. Representative Millett, through the chair.
Well, how could your personal opinions not influence the way you handle litigation if you're the final arbiter of what the public interest is?
Well, Representative Ledoux, I'm trying to take this from the air to the ground. That's what I always try to say. You can talk theoretically about this stuff, but it's a lot easier if you take an example. So, for instance, I'm just trying to think of what I disagreed with in HB 4 that I testified about. And the one thing that comes to mind was how some of the tariff provisions work under the bill. So my personal view and testimony at the time was that I thought that there was a better way to structure some of the tariff filings. But HB 4 passed, and that's the law of the land, and certainly I will act consistently and do what the law of the land says.
Representative Klayman.
And I was not present when you were testifying in prior years about HB 4. Were you there personally as Craig Richards' citizen, or were you there as Craig Richards' representative of a particular client, possibly the city of Valdez?
Representative Klayman, that's a good point. I was there on behalf of a particular client.
And a follow-up, so was the position of the city of Valdez also your personal view, or were you strictly working in your role as a counsel for the city of Valdez?
It was in my capacity as the counsel for the city of Valdez.
Any further questions? Representative Grunberg, I knew you'd
have something.
Never mind. Well, go right ahead, Representative Grunberg.
All of us in private practice, and I think probably in public practice too, come across things from time to time where we disagree with our client on either substance or procedure. How have you handled those? And that may be too broad for you to answer. If it is, that's an acceptable. I can't answer it. It's too broad. Try to answer it if you can, through the chair.
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair. So, obviously, I can't speak about specific circumstances where I've disagreed with my client. But I can tell you that any practicing attorney has that happen. And in private practice, the approach I've taken, which is probably the same approach every lawyer in this room has taken, is to work with your client, explain your disagreement as to the policy matter or the strategy matter, give them your fullest and best opinion, and then as the distinction was made on matters involving strategy, it was ultimately your client's decision.
And what?
It was your client's decision, ultimately. But you go out of your way to make sure that they're fully informed about your point of view and why you're suggesting to them another course of action might be appropriate.
I used to practice shared space with
you, the chair.
I used to practice shared space with a guy who would say, you know, the client suffers the consequences of their own decision ultimately. Is that your philosophy too?
I mean, at the end of the day, when you're in private practice, I believe that a client has the right to make their own decisions about their own cases. But I've also generally found, at least in my practice, if I fully inform my client and explain the consequences, you could generally at least come to some middle ground as to an approach to take. But I'm sure not all attorneys have been so lucky as to have clients that you've been able to do that with.
Through the chair. It may be more difficult when you have 60 legislators and God knows how many people in the executive branch and 700,000 citizens trying to figure out what everybody wants, but good luck. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I hear from the committee any further questions from Mr. Richards? Well, I would like to see if there's anybody either online or in the audience who has any questions for Mr. Richards, who would like to testify. Hearing none, public testimony is now closed. Thank you, Mr. Richards. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for your willingness to serve.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
May I have a motion to forward Mr. Richards' name to the joint session of the House and Senate for consideration?
Madam Chair, I move Craig Richards' application for confirmation as Attorney General to the body as a whole. How we would vote here is no indication of how we may vote on the floor. Thank you for your willingness.
There being no objection, Mr. Richards' name was advanced from the House Judiciary Committee. Our next committee meeting will be 1 p.m. on Wednesday. We are adjourned now.